You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, candy won, candy won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Blake and Ulig and Plumbers and Gas Fitters Local 8. Blake and Ulig, PA, advocates for labor for over 40 years, proudly representing organized labor and its members throughout Missouri and Kansas. And Plumbers and Gas Fitters Local 8 has been a part of Kansas City since 1890. The plumber protects the health of the nation. We thank our underwriters for their support to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. And on tonight's show, meet Vicki Hale, the new president of UAW Local 31. As their first ever woman prez, she's a pioneer woman. And last week, adjunct professors raised hell along with fast food and other low-wage workers. Find out why they've become the sweatshop workers of the 21st century higher education. In the news, strawberries again? Yep, another boycott for labor rights. And Russian workers protest non-payment of wages. Our feature at the end of the show is Washington Window on Workers with Mark Grunberg, and we'll talk about the fast track bill. Now for the news.
And this is the news from our side for April 23rd, 2015. In Russia, where the economy is in recession, oil prices are down and the economic sanctions because of the Ukrainian crisis are taking a bite, many workers have not been paid in months. The New York Times reports that across Russia, from teachers and construction workers in the Far East to Ford auto workers in St. Petersburg, workers are complaining and striking. Despite the recession, Russian companies tend to avoid laying workers off. They want to avoid mandatory severance payments or the wrath of officials trying to minimize unemployment in their districts. So people keep working without pay or get put on mandatory vacations. It's reckoned that workers were owed about $56 million as of April 1st. One protest of construction workers actually worked. At the prestigious new National Space Center in Siberia, the Vostokny Cosmodrome, over 1,000 laborers laid concrete and built gigantic hangars for rockets long after salaries stopped in December. Most work stopped on March 1st, though dozens of employees stayed at the site to guard equipment. They decided to protest by turning the roofs of houses into giant message boards saying, "Dear Putin, 4 months without pay." After the message appeared, a Russian state television crew showed up to ask the workers to appear on a televised call-in show with Mr. Putin. Hours before the show, the general contractor paid about 80% of the salaries to the 70 who remained at the Space Center and paid a portion to the rest who had left. Putin then was on the TV program and said he would ensure the whole group was paid in full. Before the show, a boss asked the workers to paint over their message to show that this dispute, at least, was resolved. But they said not until all were paid. They did update the message to 3 months without pay.
30,000 people in its year-round berry production and distribution network is now facing intensified pressure over the working conditions at some of their suppliers' farms. In Mexican Baja California, thousands of farm laborers stopped work for nearly 2 weeks. According to the laborers, Driscoll's suppliers in Mexico refused to respect even the minimal worker rights afforded under their labor laws. Farm workers in Mexico often come from the impoverished indigenous population and before striking were earning only $7 to $8 a day. The strike ended in April when growers signed agreements raising wages but only by 15%, not near the $13 a day the workers had initially demanded. Driscoll's supplier, Berrymex, responded to the labor actions by putting out a statement claiming workers could earn $5 to $9 an hour, a claim the laborers in Baja California find very dubious. The farm laborers in Mexico are mostly indigenous, and their inability to speak Spanish is part of why they wind up doing underpaid and marginalized work. Many of them, after they spend some time learning berry picking in Mexico, cross the border into the U.S. and work on the West Coast for higher wages. Driscoll's suppliers in Washington State are also facing increasing pressure from the farm laborers, and suppliers are now committing to paying a $10 minimum wage starting this season. While Driscoll's is the target of the consumer boycott, they insist that labor negotiations between farmers and farm workers are not their responsibility. Activists and organizers working on this issue told In These Times that their end objective is to force Driscoll's to use suppliers that respect labor rights. The fact that the CEO of Berrymex, Driscoll's primary supplier, is the brother of the CEO of Driscoll's presents an unusual challenge to laborers and organizers confronting America's most recognizable berry brand.
On June 26, 2014, the Heartland Labor Forum interviewed Trent DeVroot of KCQIC concerning new jobs for community healthcare workers and how to acquire the training to qualify for them because they were hiring. Here is our follow-up. First of all, good news. Mid-America Regional Council, along with Metropolitan Community College and our Missouri State officials, have been successful and have curriculum approved and grant money for retraining. A lot of it. They have a lot of money for the next 3 years. Metropolitan Community College is currently enrolling for the certificate program, and in the fall will be adding the new community health worker degree. Positions are available for employment at KC Cares in their clinic, as well as KCQIC. KCQIC continues to reduce the number of readmissions for 12 local hospitals, and savings for Medicare has been significant. The need for these trained workers is increasing, and the applications for kinds of work and businesses are as well. This is a good-paying job. To let me refresh, these workers assist in many healthcare situations non-medically, and they work with patient education for many conditions such as diabetes, congestive heart failure, and others. They also are friendly healthcare coaches to assist patients for staying on a program. Statistics show that they do have success. So if this is something that you would like to do, they are currently accepting applications or for information, call Sandy Snook at 816-604-4918 or sandy.snook, S-N-O-O-K, at mcckc.edu. And the translation of the curriculum is currently being, has begun, so soon it will be available in both languages.
And this is an editorial. I'm Judy Ansel, and it's my opinion and not KKFI's or UMKC's. It's a letter to the editor that I wrote and got published in today's Kansas City Star. It writes, it goes, the Star editorial on April 20th, Americans need to see details of trade deal, is correct in demanding transparency on the Trans-Pacific Partnership and saying no on fast track. Democrats and Republicans alike have peddled so-called free trade deals since the North American Free Trade Agreement in 1993. There's a disturbing pattern here. One, the president and his boosters come up with some phony study promising thousands of new jobs. Two, the media echo it but don't fact check. Three, the president sells the deal to members of Congress promising bridges, air bases, and appointments. No one reads the agreement to find out that it surrendered our rights to buy locally made goods, protect our resources, stop poisonous food imports, or maintain jobs that pay family wages. People never talk about how the shiny new agreement was ghostwritten by the biggest corporate lobbyists in the pack. They are silent about the investor-state dispute settlement system, which lets foreign corporations overrule our laws in rigged, unaccountable international tribunals. President Barack Obama and Republican leaders, with a few Democrats, are now pushing the Trans-Pacific Partnership and Fast Track, or otherwise known as Trade Promotion Authority, to grease the wheels for passage. Tell your elected representatives that you're sick of this free trade swindle. If you work, breathe, eat, or believe in self-government, tell them vote no. That's the news from our side. The news tonight was read by Jen Zaman, Hester Dusick, and I'm Judy Ansel.
Hello, Heartland Labor Forum listeners. This is Susan Sanders bringing you another episode of Pioneer Women. As you know, on our Pioneer Women series, we showcase a woman who has seemingly broken through the glass ceiling in her workplace, a woman who has been successful in doing a job that is usually done by a man. Tonight's guest is Vicki Hale, president of Local 31 of the United Auto Workers Union here in Kansas City. Welcome to our show, Vicki.
Thank you, Susan, very much. I'm happy to be here.
Well, you know, Vicki, I know our listeners would like to hear what you used to do before you became president. Did you work in a factory?
I did work in a factory. I've worked in a factory for 30 years. I started in St. Louis at the Wentzville factory, transferred to Saturn, where we made the famous Saturn brand, and in 2009, in the downturn for General Motors, transferred to Kansas City, the Fairfax assembly plant.
I see. Well, was there someone in your family who worked with cars?
Yes. My whole family has worked with cars. My father was corporate communications with General Motors, and my mom was a labor relations representative in the plant. And then we magically got hired, my brother and sister and I, so the whole family's in.
So, in other words, you grew up with General Motors.
Yes, we grew up with General Motors.
I see. Well, of all the family members, was there someone in particular who was sort of like a mentor to you?
Not in my family, because the dichotomy in my family was my parents were management.
Yes.
And us three kids were union members.
Okay. What was the difference?
Well, we are represented by the union, and management is management, and we bargain with management.
Okay, gotcha. All right. So then, was that sort of like in any family, there's going to be a little bit of negotiating between the kids and the parents? So,
well, it was fun. We, you know, dinner conversations were fun until we all moved out of the house. That was for sure, because management has their perspective of their side of the table, and so does the union. Uh-huh. And we believe in collective bargaining, and management doesn't believe in that so much.
They want to make the profit.
Correct.
Okay. Well, were you like a tomboy when you were growing up?
I could be considered a tomboy, absolutely. I loved my roller skates. Back in the day, you know, my age, we were outside from sunup to sundown, and I definitely was a tomboy. There's no doubt about it.
Okay.
Played football with the guys and softball with the guys and wore my roller skates everywhere.
So do you think that helped you in your negotiating with men today? They say, you know, that team sports helps build a sense of knowing how to create alliances and so forth. And I just wondered if you see any connection there.
I do see connection with that. You know, I'm on a team right now, and it's called an executive board.
Yeah.
And we're all elected, and just like any team, if you're a baseball team, you're selected, and you have to come together, and it takes a mentality of team building.
Right.
And not everybody gets along, and you have to figure out and navigate your way through that so you can become a cohesive team. And, you know, we represent a membership of 3,400 people.
Here in Kansas City.
Here in Kansas City.
Uh-huh.
And it takes a team to do that. And when, you know, when I got elected, we weren't all playing on the same team.
So, Vicki, I know our listeners would like to know, really, was there some kind of a burning desire in you to be in management, even though you were so interested in unions?
Well, I am a union member. I've never been a member of management. I've
okay.
always been a member of the union. For me to run for president, mm-hmm. I came to Fairfax in 2009. It's a political job. And my mentors in my past, sometimes it's not appropriate for you to run. Sometimes you should run for office and sometimes you shouldn't run for office.
Can you explain a little more about that?
We have an election every 3 years for an executive board, and all executive board positions are available for anybody to run.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got here in 2009, till new on the block here, it
right.
wasn't appropriate for me to run. You know, I didn't know anybody. But I came from being an elected official, so I've had the experience of running for the job.
So then when you came, were you sort of like, not necessarily demoted, but you had to go...
Start over.
You had to start over.
Yep,
okay.
I came in, walked in the door at Fairfax, and started on the line building cars again.
Wow. So, I mean...
Once you have that in your blood, it doesn't go away. It's like riding a bike.
Really?
And you can't, in my opinion, you should never forget where you came from.
Okay.
So if it's building the cars, then you go back out there and you get on your horse and you build cars and you build good quality cars.
So was there a particular model you were always working on? The reason I ask, I have a Pontiac Solstice convertible, and Pontiac went away.
Pontiac went away. So did Saturn.
Yeah.
Yes.
They were sister cars.
Sister cars. I have built everything from Buicks to Saturns to Malibus and Buick LaCrosses.
And so, now this is just a little sideline, but I understand that Buicks are very popular in Japan.
They are popular in Japan. North or South Korea,
yeah.
It's a luxury car over there. And they build them in South Korea as well as the Malibu they build in South Korea.
But it's still General Motors.
It's still General Motors.
So, I want to go back to you working in the factory. I mean, were you like working with a robot, or were you actually using the screwdriver yourself?
Absolutely. It's called assembly.
Uh-huh.
And I've done everything from install EA shocks to inspect paint on a car. And you earn those stripes, though. It's because it's a seniority-based system. Well, you start with the not-so-good jobs in what we call trim department or chassis, and they're not fun. You are assembling cars.
Yeah.
Some of it's difficult. Some
uh-huh.
of it's very technical.
Uh-huh.
Some of it's safety-related. But no matter what, whether you're building a chassis of a car or you're paint inspecting a car, we believe in the UAW, and all of our workers do, that you do this to the 100% of your ability. And I have arthritis to prove that I've done all of it.
Well, I'm glad to hear. I mean, I'm not glad to hear you have arthritis, but I like that idea of, you know, putting your own heart into it, even though you're not building the whole car. You might just be building the rear view mirror.
That's true. And some people never see the entire car built.
Uh-huh.
If you're back in body shop stamping doors, you never see the entire car. You may never see the entire car come off the end of the final process line.
Well, I've heard two things about doctors and operations and auto workers and when the car is finished. Never buy a car and never get an operation on Monday or Friday. If the car was finished on Monday or if the car was finished on Friday, don't. What do you think of that?
That's old, antiquated thinking. We have so many quality systems built into manufacturing a vehicle,
mm-hmm.
and you have an ID number that's attached to your job.
Okay.
So if anything goes wrong, it can be traced back to you as an individual on what time you built that car, touched that car, assembled that car.
Oh, good.
So those days are long, long over for that misconception to be out there.
Well, Vicki, since you worked your way up and had been at the top before and then you had to go right back down, and you know it inside and out, how did you make the leap here from working on the line to going into it's not management like running the company, but running the union? How did you do that?
I took baby steps.
Okay.
Since I was already an elected official back in Spring Hill, Tennessee at the Saturn plant, I came with a skill set already of how to run for office and the passion to run for office and the passion for my union.
Mm-hmm.
When I got here, when we landed here in Kansas, I needed to learn the ropes again. And it's all new people. It's an all new membership that you have no relationship with.
Were they as friendly as the people in Smyrna, Tennessee?
No.
I didn't think so.
No. And honestly, you know, we came in on their territory. Now, the blessing is the UAW had us bargained a contract for us not to lose our employment and that we could transfer somewhere and still remain gainfully employed. Mm-hmm. So that is the power of the collective bargaining process. Mm-hmm. But you're invading someone's territory.
Right.
And you, it took us a while to come together because people came from all over the United States. They came from Wisconsin. They came from Shreveport, Louisiana. They came from Bowling Green, Kentucky. They came from Lansing, Michigan.
To run for office in the union?
No, to be employed.
Oh, to be employed at the factory.
Yeah, this was in 2009 when all these plants shut down across the United States.
Oh, I see.
So they offered you, here's your shot to remain employed.
I see.
And you picked a plant, and that's where you went to. Mm-hmm. And there was, I'd probably say, 2,000 of us transferred here from all over the country.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So out of that 2,000, how did you get from the factory line into your union management?
You get involved. Uh-huh. I started out on committees. We have what we call standing committees. And we have Women's Committee, Civil Rights Committee, Skilled Trades Committee. These are just a couple I'm naming.
Right.
And you get involved, and you get involved in community activities. And you get involved in participating in your union. You come to your union meetings. You talk and you ask questions and you get involved. Mm-hmm. Involvement is most of the part of it, so you can get your name out there and people understand that you're always there, that you're dependable, and that you believe in what you're doing.
Well, you know, to prepare for our discussion this evening, what I did was review the film Norma Rae.
Oh.
Because I don't know that much about I mean, I'm knowing more and more about unions, but it seemed like in the film, Norma Rae created quite a ruckus getting involved in building a union. Now, you came in and the union was already there.
Yes.
But are there factions within the company that would fight against the workers' rights?
Well, management always has their opinion of how things should be.
Yeah.
But thankfully for the union, we have, over the years and years and years since the UAW was born, you know, we have created OSHA. We've created...
I didn't know that. Well, now, for our listeners, OSHA is the organization...
Occupational Safety and Health.
Okay.
You know, safe working environments, prevailing wage, maternity leave, 40-hour work weeks, overtime provisions... American Disabilities Act. Everything that we've bargained in our contracts is a result of something bigger that now the rest of the United States enjoys.
I see. Well, that's impressive. Let me go back to, like, the history of unions. When I think of the Auto Workers Union, I think of Jimmy Hoffa. How do you get away from that stereotype?
Well, I think over the years, number one is our generosity and our community involvement is one of them. And we try very hard. We, our plant alone, a Local 31, UAW Local 31, the membership alone contributes over $50,000 of their generosity to the community. And that could be through the United Way. That could be through donating coats. That could be through collecting gate collections for our veterans in our community.
Uh-huh.
We're a very generous organization. I will say, though, as hard as we try to change our perception, the political factions in our country work overtime discrediting us. So it's kind of like the proverbial, you know, stepchild. You try and try and try and try and try, and they just outdo us with money.
I see.
It's a vicious cycle. It's a vicious cycle, and the Koch brothers are part of that. You know, I don't want to turn this into a political discussion.
I love politics, but I understand what you're saying.
You know, they fight, and right now in the state of Missouri, the Payroll Protection Act. We call it the Payroll Deception Act, because what that really means is they don't want you to have union dues taken out of your paycheck.
I see.
So every, they're creating legislation, and they have power, and they have money. They have the right to work. They're trying to push right to work. They're trying to push a national right to work bill now. And that's all funded by not only the Koch brothers, but many other people who, they wake up every day thinking of how they can throw the union under their bus, when most of America doesn't understand a lot of the stuff that you're protected by for American Disabilities Act is just
right.
one thing was
yes.
born out of us collective bargaining and protecting our members.
Well, now going back to your being selected rather than appointed to your position as president, how long is your term and how did you campaign?
Well, I'm elected. Mm-hmm. I was elected by the membership. It's a 3-year term. Mm-hmm. I'm coming up on 1 year. This June. It'll be my first year in office.
Uh-huh.
And it takes a lot of work. You are by yourself and you have to campaign on 3 shifts and do your job. So we have a 3-shift operation. I would go in at 2:30 in the morning and campaign on 3rd shift.
Oh my gosh.
And you, for 4 hours campaign, so you got to shake everyone's hand.
Yes.
And then I would go to my job and work from 6:30 a.m. till 2:30 in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would stay over for 4 hours on to 2nd shift and campaign on 2nd shift.
Oh, yes.
And you do this for weeks and weeks and weeks at a time. And people get mad at you if you don't shake their hand. Now, they may not vote for you, but they'll let you know you didn't shake my hand.
I see.
So,
was there a platform you campaigned on? I mean, what separated you from the other contestants?
What separated me was the membership wanted change.
Mm-hmm.
And the incumbents that were in office had been there for 12 years, and they wanted change. And I have some newer ideas, some fresher ideas, and I just put it out there, and I walked and talked on that plant floor. It's a gamble. You mm-hmm. have a 50-50 shot at it.
Right.
I've lost many campaigns, and I've won many campaigns. If I lost, I'd just go back to doing my job.
What would you say, Vicki, has been your greatest victory in being president of the Local 31 UAW?
I have a lot of little victories inside the UAW.
Yes.
But my biggest victory out of all of this is that my husband and son stand by my side. That's my victory.
Oh, beautiful. Tell our listeners how that works. Now, I understand your husband also works at the factory on a forklift.
He does. He drives a fork truck 8 hours a day mm-hmm. and supports me 100%. You wouldn't know my husband. He doesn't say much. We're the opposite of each other. He drives his fork truck every day and clocks in and clocks out and comes home. But he loves to hear what I have to say at the end of every day.
Does that ever create what you might call a conflict of interest?
No, because we're both union members.
Okay, do you have to, guard some of the things you say to him because he's not in management?
No. We are, my husband is my rock and he's my sounding board. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, it's good to have somebody that's opposite of you in the house.
Yeah.
Because you might be talked down out of a tree, I'm just using that.
Sure.
And he's a good sounding board for me, maybe you better take a little bit different turn on this one.
Does he also give you insights about how the current working situation is?
He does, because he's on the plant floor every day.
Yeah.
So he hears, the factories are little anthills
mm-hmm.
with thousands of people in them.
Mm-hmm.
And the rumor mill is alive and well in every factory. And so he's got his ear to the floor. And I hear what's going on the plant floor.
Vicki, do you feel this is the type of work that women ought to aspire to? And if so, what would you say the steps are for a female listener who's wondering about getting into management in her union?
You have to have a desire.
Yes.
You have to be well read.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to have chutzpah, because people come at you from every angle that you never thought of in your life, and you have to have somebody that supports you. Like I mentioned, my husband.
Yes.
And I think all women should do this. There's women in our community that I aspire to be like. Elise Martini's one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, are just rocks and solid pillars in our community and our union women. And we all got involved young, and we all got involved and stayed involved. You have to have a desire for it, and you have to have a love for it.
Well, then, in what ways do you feel a woman may be better suited for your position than a man?
I don't know why I'm stumped on that question, because it does take a certain personality to want to do this.
Okay.
And you have to love it, and you have to love people. And you have to love good people and bad people.
Okay.
Because they come at you at all different angles. I think anybody's suited for the job, but you have to really want to do it, and you can't do it halfway.
Well, then, let me ask it a different way. Are there situations that you think are more difficult because you are a woman?
I do, because it's a male-dominated environment.
Okay. How do the men relate to you?
pretty well so far, but I was questioned when I campaigned, why should I vote for a woman?
And how'd you answer? And,
well, I was quite shocked, actually, in this day and age to be asked that. But I turned the tables and said, why wouldn't you vote for a woman?
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Vicki, president of Local 31 of the United Auto Workers Union, for being our guest this evening on Heartland Labor Forum. We've really enjoyed and appreciated your sharing with us about your work. And to our listeners, this is Susan Sanders reminding you that sometimes the best man for the job is a woman.
Funding for KKFI provided by the Weekly Forum at All Souls UU Church. Each Sunday at 10 a.m., the forum will feature a discussion on community issues. All Souls UU Church is at 4501 Walnut Street, one block east of Main in Kansas City. More information is at allsoulskc.org.
Tune in on Saturday afternoons for real, local, talk radio, community programming. Starting at 3 o'clock p.m., Every Woman with Sharon Lockhart and Amy Bell. 4 o'clock p.m., Urban Connections with Donna Morrow Wolf. 5 o'clock p.m., Guess Who's Coming to Kansas City with M.C. Richardson.
My name is Jung Y. Veen Young, V. Tran. I'm a preacher's kid and the son of butchers. My family came to America with the clothes on our backs, and we built from there. All my life, my family has asked me to tell our story, but I couldn't. Until now. Tune in Thursday, April 23rd at 8 p.m. to the local showcase to hear The Butcher Son, live on KKFI 90.1.
And moan, moss does not cling to a rolling stone. My body, if I could choose, I would to ashes it reduce, then let the merry breezes blow my dust to where some flower grows. Perhaps some fate.
And that's John McCutcheon with his new song, Joe Hill's Last Will. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum when we have a special with John McCutcheon on his new CD, marking the 100th anniversary of the execution of songwriter and IWW organizer Joe Hill. That's next week on the Heartland Labor Forum.
And I'm Molly Madden, and you are listening to the Heartland Labor Forum on KKFI 90.1 Community Radio. In the Chronicle of Higher Education, graduate students, May 6, 2012, there is an article entitled The PhD Now Comes with Food Stamps. These are stories about adjunct professors who are non-tenured teachers who teach one or more classes and have no benefits. They may even be collecting food stamps, Medicaid, and WIC if they have children. Many bounce on and off unemployment or welfare during the semester breaks, or they may wait tables or bag groceries alongside their students. Today we have three adjunct professors here to talk about the working conditions, including their pay. On the phone we have Autumn Cahill. Autumn, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, great, great. And in the studio we have Liz Jacquino. Hello, Liz.
Hi.
Hi. And Bo is on his way, so let's get going. We wanted each person to talk about their working conditions, including their pay. So could we start with you, Liz?
So I work at UMKC, and I teach Discourse 100, which is a composition class, right? It's in the English department. And I'm paid $2,500 per course. So that is what I'm paid, and we, you know, there's no other benefits to that. That's just the base pay, is that's all you get.
Okay. And how about you, Autumn?
Well, I guess I should clarify that I'm actually not an adjunct. I'm a GTA, so that stands for Graduate Teacher Assistant.
Okay.
I'm sure after I get my MA, which ostensibly will be happening in 3 weeks, God willing, I could apply to be an adjunct, either at UMKC or another institution in the area. So to kind of juxtapose my situation with Liz, I make about twice what she does per class. And I also get a tuition remission, so essentially I get free tuition, and I do get something to live off of. So that kind of juxtaposes the difference in our particular school and department between an adjunct and then a GTA.
That sounds like a better deal. Well, Bo has made it here.
Yeah, I would think so.
Okay. And how about you, Bo?
Well, I teach an artist entrepreneurial course at the Conservatory of Music at UMKC, which I am just fresh from. So I told my students to listen, so hopefully they are.
And you're a musician, right?
Yes, yes.
Great. Okay. I'm wondering how people pay off their student loans with this low wage. Is your loan interest deferred? And I went also, do people have to apply for public assistance in this group?
I can say that a lot of adjuncts that I know, they submit kind of what they make per year, and they get a reduced cost, or not a reduced cost, but a reduced payment plan where they pay, you know, anywhere from $11 to $40. But that just prolongs paying off the inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
For myself, I won't be able to afford with the loans that I have taken out to just do adjuncting full-time. So I'll be adjuncting in addition to a full-time job in order to pay back my student loans. That's my plan for the fall.
And you have another job?
Right now I'm working at Operation Breakthrough, making a very similar wage to adjuncting, except I teach, or I work at a daycare for 0 to 5-year-olds.
Wow. Get paid the same.
Yeah, it's very strange.
Yeah. And there's no holiday pay because there are no benefits, right? What do you do for Christmas gifts, everyone? That's a joke.
Bo, what do you do? I make homemade gifts, personally. I mean, the vanilla extract comes out, right? Because I just buy some vanilla beans and some vodka and then call it fancy.
Okay. Now, are any of you paid by the size of your class? How is it? How does that go? Does it?
No,
are you in?
I don't believe so.
Oh, okay.
Nope.
And you don't have any of you travel from one college to another?
Well, I used to. I mean, I when I first graduated, I was adjuncting a lot, and it soon became apparent it really wasn't a viable career path because you do travel quite a bit from class to class, and you are not compensated for that usually, and. And I just started teaching adjunct again this semester, and I'm just trying to impart on my students in this class that it's actually very difficult because many of them have on their long-term goals to become professors, and I don't think that they realize what they're getting themselves into.
Maybe we can change that. Hopefully. Now, do any of you have designated office space to prepare for your classes?
I don't actually. Well, it's sort of a tricky thing. So our department gave us an office space, and then their resources got cut kind of thin, and so they gave it to another instructor. And that office space that was an adjunct office space was for 5 adjuncts. Right now, I work out of the graduate teaching office because I was a graduate teacher for 2 years prior to adjuncting. And so I'm sort of not supposed to be there, but I work there anyways.
Sounds like we have some lucky ducks here. Now, are there any paid training opportunities, like conferences you can go to, and would the school reimburse you, you know, if you wanted to further your,
you know,
stay up to par?
No, and I know that graduate students get, you know, $100 to compensate them if they go to a conference. But I mean,
that wouldn't cover too much.
No, not at all. Okay. And that's the graduate students. I'm not sure if that's extended to the adjuncts. I believe it is, but I can't be sure on that. So, but $100 is, yeah, it's not quite enough.
And about the materials or support for your class preparation, do you have problems with that? Anyone?
Well, you have to spend many hours preparing for class, and of course that's uncompensated, and you don't have office hours, so the student really doesn't have the same access as they do with other professors, and I personally think that kind of cheapens the degree if the student doesn't have that kind of access, and I had that in school, and it was invaluable, and I feel bad for my students that don't have that option.
Yeah, they're cheating the students too. That's terrible.
I will say too, a lot of adjuncts really donate their time to their students, and I feel that way, you know, when I'm emailing them back extensively, you know, I feel like I'm constantly donating my time because, I mean, I'm paid for 10 hours of work per course, but there's just no way that I get it all done in 10 hours a week, so.
Now, I'm wondering, you know, the students are paying more tuition, and I'm wondering where all the money's going. Is it true that the administration has gotten like a 75% increase in their salaries, or I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, I can say over the last 35 years, the top administrators' pay has increased at a rate of 3 times that of faculty.
Wow.
So, yeah, there's some academic, or I'm sorry, there's some administrative bloat.
Wow, that's something else. So what percentage of the faculty is tenured, and what faculty is full-time, and what percentage are adjuncts? And could you explain, like, the full-time, the difference?
Yeah, so there's kind of two ways that people kind of add this up. They either talk about, you know, how many percentage of people are adjuncts, and then how many percentage of people are off the tenure track or don't qualify for the tenure track. Adjuncts, you know, as we've kind of been talking, usually don't have a contract, they don't have office space, they don't have benefits, and there's kind of different levels. So, of non-tenure track people, but there's graduate teachers, who Autumn is a graduate teacher. They usually get about a 2-year contract, something depending on, you know, their education that they're getting in graduate school. And then another sort of non-tenure track faculty member is the full-time instructor. They usually have a contract somewhere between a year, maybe 3 years. I don't know anything longer than that.
Are they apt to go tenured? I mean, it depends.
Yeah, I mean, that's not where the trend is going. I mean, it's so cheap to hire adjuncts and full-time lecturers and graduate teachers that there's just historically been an increase. In 1969, approximately 78% of faculty were tenured, and now it's declined to 33%, 34%.
That's quite a decline.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think UMKC is about 65% adjunct.
Yeah, and we have a very high percentage of graduate teachers as well. They do a big, adjuncts and graduate teachers do a big bulk of the gen eds.
Okay. Do you know from semester to semester what you're going to teach? How, you know, and if there aren't enough students who sign up for a class and they have to cancel, how soon do they notify you?
That was a big surprise in my contract because that verbiage was not in my contract with UMKC. And it was looking like my class wasn't going to happen. And, of course, I've made all of these plans and adjusted my schedule. You know, I'm primarily a professional musician, so I have all of these different dates to juggle. And was just kind of met with the shrug of a shoulder that, you know, I may not have the class after all. And I've never really been treated that way. That was a real surprise.
Well, I'm really glad the adjuncts have hooked up with the low-wage workers. And What do you see that you might have in common with these low-wage workers? And I think it was a wonderful idea.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we have a lot in common with low-wage workers. I mean, we kind of talked about there's no job security, right? And that's mm-hmm. definitely seen with other low-wage workers. We have to cobble together 2 to 3, 4 jobs in order to kind of get by. Mm-hmm. That definitely happens in the low-wage demographic. And there's also, I mean, we're paid low, just like them. I mean, not for our qualifications, definitely.
And the corporate model has kind mm-hmm. of infected the universities now, so we're dealing in a very similar structure.
So, Autumn, are you thinking going it some other way? She's okay now, but
in regards to PhD or adjuncting or
right. What do you think? Have you made up your mind?
Well, with regards to this adjunct fast food worker thing, I mean, it's kind of a classist thing when you tell people you're going to school for something, you need your BA or MA, and they ask what for. So in my case, it would be English. Mm-hmm. And I personally have not been faced with this scenario, but I have heard of this as kind of a stock scenario of like joking, where do they teach you to say, do you want fries with that? Mm-hmm. But, you know, it seems to integrate the work that fast food worker or whatever hourly worker is doing. However, if we're looking at the other tip of that scale, that's where you would stereotype like dropouts or something is going to go do, which is definitely not the case all the time. But if you're going to go get an institutional job, in which case a professor would, I think, be an example. Mm-hmm. If they're facing the same thing, same backlash or difficulties as that hourly worker, it's just kind of like a condemnation either which way, regardless of what career path you choose with that.
So if some other opportunity popped up, you'd hop on it, I imagine.
and again, this is where my situation's a little different. I'm kind of protected by that dual student and teacher label at the moment. I also do have another job that's a 30-hour to 40-hour type job.
Oh, okay.
I do like teaching, but I will say probably for at least in your future after getting this MA, I'll probably be sticking with that.
Okay. That's good. Now, what I'm wondering is also, how are adjuncts organizing across the country and locally? You know, is maybe the East Coast or West Coast or a little more ahead of us, more progressive, or we catching up?
I have a friend who was I haven't spoken to him recently, but I will say a classmate of mine from an undergrad in Clayton. Mm-hmm. Who just a few years ago, he went to grad school a little earlier than I did. I took a couple years off between undergrad and grad to work for money and stuff to live. But I believe it was Amherst University he went to, and as early as a couple years ago, they were already unionizing and striking. I believe there was a dispute about GTAs actually being paid on time.
Wow.
Was the first I had heard of that, and I believe he's kind of been in that circuit ever since then.
So even this program has problems. Okay. One last...
That was very institution, of course.
Okay. One last quick question, Liz. Have you figured out the percentage of money that the student pays that you receive? I think you told me earlier that you figured that out.
I have 22 students, and they each approximately pay about $1,000 for 3-credit course, my course. So the university gets $22,000, and what I get paid is 11%, $2,500. Mm-hmm. That's one thing that, Autumn's totally right. We're organizing in D.C. and Boston, St. Louis, with Faculty Forward, and we're asking for $15,000 per course. Mm-hmm. And we're asking for not just base pay, but also job security, benefits, so maternity leave, you know, everything that we're not
things that
right
all
now.
Workers should have.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, any last words? We need to wrap it up.
No, it was just great to have us.
Okay. Well, I thank you all. You were all wonderful. I learned a lot. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel with this month's Washington Window on Workers. And with me on the line from Washington, D.C. is Mark Grunberg of PAI. I can never remember what that stands for, Mark. What is that? Press Associates, Inc. That's it.
Press Associates Incorporated, but our real name, our use name is Press Associates Union News Service.
Okay, so we're going to get the union news here. And I want to talk to you about Fast Track. So lots happening in Washington right now with Fast Track, and there's demonstrations all over the country. I don't want to forget to mention that there's one here tomorrow that's being sponsored by communications workers at Senator Claire McCaskill's office at 10 a.m. on Pennsylvania, 41st and Pennsylvania in Westport, and then moving on to Senator Blunt's office. And just a quick feint to that, Mark, you saw Blunt speak at the Building Trades Conference. What was that all about?
Yeah, he did. The building trades had a parade of politicians come in, mostly Democrats, but two Republicans. Blunt was the first one, and he was actually the leadoff speaker. He talked mostly about infrastructure, talked about saying we should have a long-term highway and mass transit bill, but he wouldn't say how to fund it. He didn't talk trade at all. For that matter, nobody talked trade at that conference, which is rather interesting. 3,000 people here and not a single thing about trade.
Interesting.
But that was the exception this week.
Okay.
Everybody else has been talking about Fast Track.
Did you attend the Senate Finance Committee hearings?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
I went to the hearing with Trumka and the senators. The Democrats were split. Several of them are for Fast Track, Ron Wyden of Oregon and Mark Warner of Virginia. The rest, Bob Casey of Pennsylvania and a couple of others, were against Fast Track. The Republicans are uniformly for Fast Track, and they plowed through a slew of amendments yesterday, tossed out all the pro-worker ones and passed Fast Track out of the Finance Committee.
Yeah.
And today they did the same thing in the House.
Oh, really? Is there a chance
in the House Ways and Means Committee? Yeah.
Is there a chance that Fast Track is going to be defeated on the floor of the House? What do you think?
Yes. At one of the rallies last week, one of the big ones that the steelworkers hosted, the lawmakers who got up there, Rick Nolan of Minnesota, who's from the Iron Range in particular, said that he felt that the vote would be very close, that there was a good chance of defeating it. Rosa DeLauro, who's one of the best vote counters, says there's at least 125 Democrats who have signed up against Fast Track in the House. And when I talked to Bill Samuel, the AFL-CIO's legislative director, he said he expects no more than a dozen Democrats will vote for it. And there's enough Republican defections that puts the House up for grabs. Which means every vote counts.
Okay, and when do you think the vote's going to be in the House?
Well, that's an interesting question. They haven't even scheduled a vote in the Senate yet, and the Senate's going to go first.
Okay.
That much was clear.
Okay. So there's some time.
When we talked to Senator Hatch afterwards.
Okay.
So we've still got some time, but we need to use that time to lobby.
Right.
So to lobby people heavily to vote against Fast Track.
Okay, and in play particularly is Senator Claire McCaskill, right? And she hasn't announced.
Right.
And I mean, there's some Tea Partiers from the Midwest who I would expect will defect from the Wall Street Republicans. But we don't have a lot of these people are really ducking making commitments at this point. You know, they're playing their cards close to the vest, and so getting them to come out would be an important thing. Okay, one last question before we run out of time, Mark. What's in this Fast Track bill? Is it the same as the other Fast Track bills that, you know, limited debate and had no amendments and you know, just had a straight up-down vote? Are there other things? Because I heard something about supposedly worker rights goals.
Well, what that is, this is the fast track bill, as opposed to the treaties that fast track would, or trade pacts that fast track would authorize. Those are the ones with the up or down votes, no amendments, and limited debate. This one, you'll still have limited debate, and in the House, you probably won't have that many amendments. But what it does have is it has a whole. I read through a good hunk of it the other day. It has a whole string of goals that. That lawmakers want our negotiators to talk about, but they aren't mandating that the negotiators reach those goals. One of them is worker rights, and another one is make it open and transparent and you know, have the treaties available to the public 90 days before a vote and things like that. But they're not ordering the negotiators, you must do this. They're only saying these are the goals we want you to reach.
Sounds like window dressing to me.
And that's quite different.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
All right.
Well, it's window dressing.
We're out of time, Mark. Keep us posted, please.
Okay.
Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you next
week. Okay.
Yep. Bye.
Talk next month. Okay. Great. Bye.
Okay, and for today's Heartland Labor Forum calendar, April 23rd, 2015, demonstration against Fast Track and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, Friday, April 25th, 10 a.m. until noon. We begin at 10 a.m. at Senator Claire McCaskill's office at 4141 Pennsylvania in Westport, and we end up at 11 a.m. in Senator Roy Blunt's office at 911 Walnut downtown, sponsored by Communication Workers of America. Transportation Equity Summit, Friday, April 25th, 8 a.m. to noon at Mary L. Kelly Community Center, 2803 East 51st Street, Kansas City, Missouri, 64130. To register, call Gloria Ortiz Fisher, 816-421-8048, or email Gloria at GORTIZ Fisher, at westsidehousing.org. Sponsored by the Kansas City Regional Equity Network and Policy Link, a national equity organization. Dr. Wes Jackson, president of the Land Institute, solving the 10,000-year-old problem of agriculture, a progress report. Wednesday, April 29th, 6 p.m. reception, 6:30 is the program, at Pearson Auditorium at UMKC, Atterbury Student Success Center, 5000 Holmes Road, Kansas City, Missouri. Show support for Kansas State Representative Val Wynn, accused of using the racist word. Next hearing, Thursday, April 30th at 2 p.m. It's room 141 South in the Kansas Capitol Building in Topeka. The hearing is open to the public. 2015, Magic Camp Mentoring a Girl in Construction for High School Girls, June 1st through 5th. Contact the Builders Association Training Center, 105 West 12th Avenue, North Kansas City, Missouri, 64116. Sponsored by NAWIC, National Association of Women in Construction, and KC Construction Industry. Call 816-564-3589 or go to kcnawic.org. And finally, Midwest School for Women Workers will be July 19th through 23rd, DePaul and Roosevelt Universities in Chicago, Illinois. For a brochure and registration and scholarships, go to http://www.midwestwomenworkers.org. Also, if you are a Coalition of Labor Union Women member, they have a scholarship too. So check us out on the Heartland Labor Forum schedule on the web at www.heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can also listen to today's show. Like us on Facebook. Just search for the Heartland Labor Forum and send us your feedback about the show.
Thanks, Hester. And that's it for the show. Tune in next week. The show is called Joe Hill, The First 100 Years with John McCutcheon. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.